The word holiday, it turns out, is a conflation of the words holy and day. You can see the root words visually, of course, by simply turning the I in holiday to a Y visually in your mind. And indeed, the original intention of a holiday is to celebrate a holy day, a day set apart from our normal routine. And at its best, holidays can be a form of sacred time. Holidays have the potential to be sacramental holy days that reconnect us with the sacred, the divine, and the holy, as however we understand and experience those words. And holidays are a time for reconnection with those we love, with those who love us, and with our own deepest self. At the same time, as we all know, holidays can also be like opening a big gift-wrapped box of stress and conflict. So this morning, as we prepare to enter into that final stretch of the holiday season for 2013, I invite us to reflect on ways that we might be able to make our respective holidays more authentically holy days of rest, of rejuvenation, and reconnection. Turning back the calendar just a month to remind ourselves of how we did the last holiday, we saw how the commercialization of the Thanksgiving holiday is making it increasingly less of a holy, set-apart time, especially for low-income retail workers. And one of my colleagues posted on Facebook that in the midst of Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, Cyber Monday, and Giving Tuesday, what's next? Should we really be calling it Credit Card Debt Tuesday and Loan Consolidation Wednesday? And to me, what that comment invites us to see is that choosing to celebrate the holidays simply, we heard earlier that lovely Shaker tune, Simple Gifts, that choosing to celebrate the holidays as simple, slow, set-apart holy days can be one of the most subversive practices you can do. As I saw on a poster recently, it had a picture of Jesus, and it said, "This is my birthday, why are you getting gifts?" I think another quote I saw was that, you know, Jesus didn't come to be the patron saint of fourth-quarter prophets. You know, we're kind of getting it wrong there. And that one of the most subversive practices you can do to resist the forces of commercialization and commodification that threatens to invade every part of our lives is to simplify and to slow down and to just do less. In the 18th century, Jean-Pierre Ducassade, a Jesuit priest, that's the same order that gave us Pope Francis. It's a little bit confusing because, of course, Francis was a Franciscan, right? But Pope Francis is a Jesuit. Anyway, that Jean-Pierre Ducassard, a Jesuit, wrote a spiritual classic titled The Sacrament of the Present Moment. The Sacrament of the Present Moment. And it's all about how being present, being mindfully, heartfully present to the fullness of each present moment, and how that can connect us to the sacred depths that infuse every aspect of our lives if we slow down enough to pay attention and notice. Similarly, the late Gerald May, a psychiatrist and spiritual teacher, describes the sacrament of the present moment this way. One is not lost in memories of the past or in fantasies of the future, but is directly conscious of whatever comes to awareness here and now. When memories, fears, hopes, or plans happen within contemplation, they don't take you out of the moment. Instead, you have a subtle, a soft appreciation that they are part of what is happening here and now. The second quality is openness, a simple receptiveness to all the thoughts and feelings, sights and sounds, and other perceptions that each moment brings. In contemplation, one is not concentrating on one important thing to the exclusion of the distracting things, nor is one avoiding, denying, distorting. Instead, there is just a gentle willingness to acknowledge whatever comes. And in contrast, though, to that sacrament of the present moment that can turn a holiday or an ordinary day into a holy day, the common experience of our own time is described in Douglas Rushkoff's book, Present Shock. when everything happens now. Rushkoff writes that our society has reoriented itself to the present moment, but not in a healthy way. Everything is live, real time, and always on. It's not a mere speeding up, it's more a diminishment of anything that isn't happening right now, and the onslaught of everything that supposedly is happening right now. In particular, the deep, extended focus needed for long-term projects that can really take us to the next level in our life, in our work, in our relationships, that's often increasingly difficult to cultivate in our society, to carve out that kind of deep focus time, because we're constantly being distracted with pinging minutia, literally pinging minutia in the present. A phone call, a text message, an email, a Facebook comment. Ding, pay attention to me. And distinct from all the spiritual writing that calls us to mindfully and heartfully embrace the fullness of the present moment, all our technological devices and the demands on our time, Rushkoff writes, do not lead us to some Zen state of infinite moment, completely at one with our surroundings, committed to others, connected to others, and aware of ourselves on a fundamental level. Rather, we tend to exist in a distracted present, where forces on the periphery are magnified and those immediately before us are ignored. Whereas the sacrament of the present moment invites us to a greater fullness, a greater connection, a greater depth, present shock leaves us distracted, fragmented, and always on the shallow surface of ourself. Most distressingly, Rushkoff reports that the 24/7 demands on our time and the ways we have set ourselves up to be potentially called, texted, emailed, Facebooked at any time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, including on supposed holidays and holy days with no time off, have resulted in an increase in average citizens experiencing symptoms formerly limited to air traffic controllers and 911 operators. In other words, being crazy busy all the time is making us crazy unhealthy. And we all have different versions of this struggle, parts that are easier or harder for us in self-care. For me, for instance, it's fairly easy, and I find it's vitally important to me to avoid exhaustion to get around 8 hours of sleep most nights. It helps, I'm sure, that Megan and I don't yet have children. It's also easy for me, especially if I'm traveling or have a lot of special events in my schedule, to skip exercising or to skip meditating. And I'm working on being more intentional about not letting those important components of my long-term health slip, sometimes for days or weeks at the time, especially after I've been traveling. And as we near the beginning of a new year, what do you need to let go of or prioritize more intentionally for your long-term health, or to reconnect to your family, to your friends, or to your own deepest self? There's an old story you may well have heard before about a pilgrim visiting a Zen master. The student bows to the master and then asks her to teach him the ancient art of Zen. He then proceeds, though, to ramble on about the many Buddhist sutras that he's studied in preparation for meeting with her. The master listens patiently and then invites the student to participate in a tea ceremony. And when it's ready, she begins pouring the tea in the pilgrim's cup, and she just keeps pouring until it's overflowing and it's pouring onto the floor. The would-be student sits up and shouts, "Stop! Stop!" as if she doesn't know what she's doing. And he says, "The cup is full. You can't get in anymore." And the master stops pouring and says, "You are like this cup. You're full of ideas about the Buddha's way. You come and ask for teaching, but your cup is already full. I can't put anything else in. Before I can teach you, you'll have to empty your cup." Like that overflowing teacup that spills messily onto the floor, overcommitting leaves us fragmented, oversaturated, and internally scattered. In a similar vein to that Zen story, I had an experience a few years ago on an actual cold day in the winter. This was in January 2009. And I entered a classroom for the first time in San Anselmo, California. It was the first day of a program in the art of spiritual direction. And the director of that program began his opening lecture with these words: "We're going to start slowly so that later we can slow down. We're going to start slowly so that later we can slow down." And I still remember that opening line now, years later, because that invitation was so counterintuitive to what I expected. More than 30 of us had traveled from all across the country for the first in a series of three annual three-week intensives. That's what they called them, intensives, these intensive residencies. We'd completed all our assigned reading in advance, so I expected him to say that we would start slowly and then hit the ground running to make the most of our time together. But that actually was paradoxically what he was trying to do, to make the most of our time together by starting slowly so that later we could slow down. And we did work hard and learn a lot, but there was also a crucial sense in which he was inviting us to experiment with a profoundly countercultural perspective. The singer-songwriter Carrie Newcomer expresses a similar sentiment in lyric form when she confesses that she's been traveling faster than my soul can go. I've been traveling faster than my soul can go. I suspect many of you can identify with that feeling, perhaps even recently, in the speed up that can sometimes lead up to the holidays. And the holidays as holy days, though, can be a chance to catch back up with your soul, with your inner sense of calm, connection, and peace. For now, I'll give you just one example of how during that three-week intensive, we were challenged to start slowly so that later we can slow down, in order to give ourselves the opportunity to let go of surface distractions and to sink more deeply into the sacrament of the present moment. In this case, we're invited to read the Bible in a particular way, although the same technique could be fruitfully applied to any text you find sacred, from the world religions or poetry or even an inspiring scientific insight. In the case of the program I was in, each day in both morning and evening chapel services, a scripture was read aloud twice. All the verses were from Acts chapter 16, and the catch was that we read only one verse per day. On the first day, we read Acts 16:1. On the second day, Acts 16:2, and so on. Now, I've read the Bible contemplatively, prayerfully before, but moving through Acts 16, which is really just a random chapter from Acts, there's nothing special about Acts chapter 16, and reading through it at the pace of one verse each weekday over the course of 3 weeks was for me an entirely new way of experiencing Scripture. In our culture, we most often read or skim text for information, but in this case, we were being challenged to read a text not for information, but for formation. Not just to glean information about the text's historical context, but to be formed by the meaning that emerged from the intersection of that text and our lives. So, Monday morning, day one, I'm sitting in chapel, the scriptures read, quote, "Paul went on also to Derbe and to Lystra, where there was a disciple named Timothy, the son of a Jewish woman who was a believer, but his father was a Greek." And then we heard that read aloud a second time, followed by silent reflection. That's it. Just that verse, and that was far from the oddest over the course of the 3 weeks. During the closing program, a group of students performed a skit that spoofed this one-verse-a-day practice, and the winner of the stupidest scripture was day 8, when the verse from Acts chapter 16, verse 8, was, quote, "So passing by Mysia, they went down to Troas." So passing by Mysia, they went down to Troas. Are you hearing anything profound yet? You could be hearing, where's Mysia? Where's Troas? Even after 8 days, my first reaction to that verse was, wow, that was short. My second reaction was to intellectualize the passage and with questions of geography, like I just shared with you. But as I sat with this verse in silence for a full 10 minutes, what stood out to me was that phrase, passing by. How did Paul and Timothy discern to pass by Mysia and to go instead to Troas? More importantly, from there I heard an invitation to reflect on what I might need to pass by in my life. In January 5th, I'll be preaching a sermon about discernment and about the ways in which it's really easy and sort of the easy part of discernment to discern good from evil. But the real tricky part of discernment is discerning good from better from best and the ways in which doing something that's good can actually keep you from doing that thing that's best, that's really at that unique intersection of your gifts and the needs of the world. And I would argue, you know, just like checking that Facebook post, you know, or checking that text message, that can be a good thing, but it can keep you from doing that better or best thing. And I would argue that I received much more benefit from spending 10 minutes reflecting contemplatively on that one verse of only 9 words than I would have gotten from skimming historical commentaries on the whole of Acts 16. Similarly, Dorothy Day, the political activist and co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, a very busy person in some ways, famously said that as much as she cared passionately about politics and about transforming the world and working for the rights of the poor, there were times in her life when she only read the newspaper once a week on Sundays. And in so doing, she found that she still kept up with all the major events in the news without getting lost in those day-to-day rabbit trails that are even worse today in our 24-hour-a-day news cycle. Day found that this practice freed her to spend time other days of the week that she might have spent reading the paper, delving into works of classic literature or classic spiritual works that she probably wouldn't have gotten to otherwise if she was just constantly following every twist and turn of the news cycle. From a different perspective, some of you may remember a story. It was in the Washington Post back in 2007 when a world-famous virtuoso violinist, Joshua Bell, who regularly sells out concerts for hundreds of dollars, participated in a social experiment in the subway system. A hidden camera was set up, and Bell played a 45-minute concert on his $3.5 million Stradivarius violin, starting at 7:51 a.m. on Friday, January 12th, in L'Enfant Plaza in Washington, D.C. Of the more than a thousand people, have any of you seen the story or seen the video? Okay, a fair amount of you. Of the more than 1,000 people that passed by, 27 gave money, including quite a few that were pennies. Most of them were on the run. He got a total of $32 in change, and I think that's because of one person that actually recognized him, I think, gave him $20. So that leaves 1,070 people who hurried by, oblivious, that only 3 feet away, many were only a few feet away from him, and few even looked up. In the manuscript version of this sermon, I'll post a link. You can actually see there's like a 3-minute video. You can kind of see the sped up version of this. It's really fascinating. And I encourage you to both read that article as well as to watch the video. And although I realize that this impromptu concert is a rare and anecdotal example, I still think about this story periodically now, years later, as a reminder to myself to slow down and try not to miss all the unexpected beauty that there is in this world, and I try to savor it, and to shift my focus whenever I can from present shock to the sacrament of the present moment. Similarly, regarding the potential of transforming our holidays truly into holy days, the singer-songwriter David Lamont has written, "There's no time like the present, and there's no present like time." He means, of course, that far more valuable than any present you can buy is the gift of being fully present for our friends and for our family on holy days, on holidays. Recently, a related New York Times article was titled, "Step Away From Your Phone!" Exclamation point. It includes the story of a group of friends who all stack their phones in the middle of the table whenever they meet for lunch or dinner so that no one is distracted during the meal. They actually have a rule that if you check your phone before the meal is over, you have to pick up the check. Another story of a family who all toss their smartphones into a vintage milk tin whenever they come in the door at the end of the day, and they all stay there, all the smartphones stay there in the tin until after dinner. or individuals who have banned digital devices from the bedroom, both to avoid being woken up in the middle of the night, as well as to not have technology be the first thing they do every day. Because they found if they left their smartphone on their bedroom, they just couldn't help themselves. The first thing they did in the morning was, you know, check technology, which just starts inculcating that distracted habit first thing in the morning. And as wonderfully helpful as technology can be, and I'm a big fan, digital detoxing is equally important and even empowering. In this article, one high-end party planner in New York reported a trend in banning cell phones in parties, except in an area outside beside the smoking area. And she says that public cell phone use has reached an uncivilized fever pitch. So now it's actually chicer to exempt yourself from checking your smartphone all the time. You're not answerable 24/7, and that's a powerful, even luxurious statement. Yesterday was winter solstice, the shortest day and longest night of the year, marking the official beginning of winter, I'm told. And last year, about this time, I preached a sermon titled "The Spirituality of Winter." Can you feel the wheel of the year turning? And in that sermon, I invited you to consider that this time of year, the practices of darkness, of silence, of letting go, and of saying no is a spiritual practice, saying no, saying yes with intention. That those practices of darkness, silence, letting go, saying no, can be particularly fruitful during the winter months. And if a spirituality of winter is all about the inward journey, when is the last time you spent some quality time with yourself, being attentive to what's going on inside of you? If a spirituality of winter is about simplicity, is there anything you feel led to let go of in your life? As we enter fully into the season of bare trees and stark landscapes, we have the opportunity to see the transformation of our external world as an invitation to ask what we need to allow to fall away in our own lives. In this season, are there ways that you feel led to give yourself permission to let go of distractions and to experiment with the sacrament of the present moment? And in so doing, may you and yours experience the upcoming holidays as sacramental, as holy days.